from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. University of California, San Francisco physician and author Louise Aronson joins us in the studio to talk about her new story collection. It's called A History of the Present Illness. Set in San Francisco, the stories draw on her experiences working with the sick and elderly in the city's hospitals and nursing homes. She's a Harvard-trained geriatrician, and she also has an MFA in fiction. We'll talk with her about a number of things next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Dr. Louise Aronson joins us for this Forum hour. Her website says, quote, a doctor and a writer, or maybe a writer and a doctor. Actually, she is both a practicing geriatrician and associate professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, as well as an award-winning fiction writer who recently published a volume of 16 short stories drawn from her medical work called A History of the Present Illness. And we should mention that she's also a native San Franciscan who is here with us in studio. Good to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here after decades of listening.
Listening forever is the way you put it.
I did, yes.
it took you almost 10 years to write this book, and little did you know that you'd be a fiction writer, I guess, since you started out wanting to be a professional basketball player. I guess you didn't know you'd be either a doctor or a fiction writer.
Not at all. Well, it was pretty clear I wouldn't be a basketball player, though, being
didn't
short
have the
and uncoordinated.
Height.
Yeah. No, there were many problems with that, but it was all a pleasant surprise. I mean, I think that I got into doctoring actually through working with refugees. In college, I actually chose my college. I went to Brown University because they had no math or science requirements. I went through the list my college counselor gave me and crossed off all schools that were going to require me to do things that would have prepared me for my current career. But in working with refugees, what I realized was that people who had needs often went to the doctor, even when those needs might have been better served by someone else, a social worker or a psychologist. And it just made me want to have those skills and that access to make a difference.
Well, working with refugees and particularly Cambodian refugees, I think, in your case,
right.
You also went to the Cambodian-Thailand border and did
right.
work there. So you've had certainly a tremendous amount of, if I may say so, admirable experience. But I was what it brought to my mind was Anne Fadiman's book. I don't know if you know it, where she was working with the Hmong people, and they were coming to her as a journalist, but she was also observing them with medical doctors, and the difficulty in translating was very weighty indeed, because they had to describe things that often had to do with feeling possessed by spirits and all those sorts of things.
Right. The Cambodians are fairly different from the Hmong in that way, but there were similar sorts of challenges. And we actually, that book is really one of the seminal ones. It deals with cross-cultural issues in medicine beautifully. So we often have our incoming medical students read The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down by Anne Fadiman.
You had different experiences in terms of the translating problems or translating even with translators in some instances
right.
To know what was going on medically?
Well, people think of translation as an issue of language, and that's part of it, but it's also culture and expression. When we're communicating, language and words are just a fraction of what we communicate. And things we assume in one culture have certain meanings don't necessarily in others. So you really need someone who is translating culturally as well as linguistically. And even then, it can be challenging. That said, there are also some universals that you can work through. So everybody cares for their children. You know, if you go in and are showing an interest in people's children, you can start forming a bond that's helpful. But it does add a layer of complexity and a distance between you and the person you're trying to care for if you need a translator.
Well, the South Asian influence is sort of brought to mind in your book because mm-hmm. there are stories involving, for example, an Indian doctor mm-hmm. Goes from her sari to her suit, mm-hmm. As you put it, and also kisses her patients. And in fact, in one instance, tells a patient, I love you. And I was very struck by this because We've had Abraham Verghese on, and he talks about the importance, the novelist and Stanford medical professor, the importance of touching patients. And touching patients is one taboo, but kissing patients and telling them you love them, that's not traditional medicine.
Right. Not at all. I think context is really important there. That particular line is a reference by a narrator, so we don't actually see her doing those things. But are there situations in which that can be appropriate? There are. I think they're by far the exception, so I don't want to go around saying that I'm advocating for all doctors to be kissing their patients. It also depends, I think, on who the physician is and who the patient is. So, for example, if you're a man kissing a female patient, particularly at all remotely in line with your age, that's probably always problematic and perhaps not fair to men who might be giving the kiss for any number of other reasons. But if you are a geriatrician like myself and you're with someone in their 90s who's in a wheelchair and doesn't see anyone but you, and you're the person who regularly comes to visit, you know, as we do house calls on older homebound San Franciscans for, you know, once a month for years, and you're going to say goodbye and they pull you in and give you a kiss, sometimes it can feel inappropriate not to reciprocate. And you do feel an affection without question, and a type of love. It's not the same as the love you feel for your family, but I do believe it's a type of love without question.
You call yourself a geriatrician, and you are a geriatrician, but I was reading something that you wrote. You have a blog as well that you wrote about the whole nature of geriatrics, considering changing that word geriatric as it's so fraught with, I guess, fear and trembling with many people's minds and so forth. And you said that's unfortunate. It is unfortunate.
It is. So I was at a meeting last fall where people were talking about, did we need to change our name? And what I mentioned in the blog is that geriatrician is a word lots of people aren't even familiar with. And it basically just means a doctor for older adults. The best analogy is probably pediatrician, a doctor for children. So
we don't want to do away with that designation.
Well,
right?
No, and I'm sure at their meetings, they're never having that discussion. And so the fact that we're talking about is the label a problem, I think actually reflects societal ageism, because the pediatricians aren't saying we need to change our name because we're associated with children, because everybody has warm feelings about children. But when they think about old age, they're frightened, or they don't want to think about it. And so that has given us not always. I mean, I think most people who've had – actually, I know this. Most people who've had associations with geriatricians are really in favor of the field, because we provide a type of care that meets the needs of older people better and more effectively, more safely, and more satisfyingly than do many other types of physicians, in the same way that a pediatrician takes better care of a child. I often like to say, if you were to line up an 8-year-old, a 40-year-old, and a 90-year-old, you know, even a child would know those are fundamentally different people. And yet in medicine, we often we treat the child and the adult as different and train people differently, but we treat the adult and the older person as the same when we all know they're different in some fundamental and really important ways.
Our guest is Louise Aronson, and again, she is Associate Professor of Medicine at UC San Francisco and also directs UCSF's Northern California Geriatrics Education Center and the UCSF Pathways to Discovery Program. She's the author of A History of the Present Illness. And we should also mention that you work with residents on writing for change and the idea of physicians writing stories, because certainly physicians have stories to tell, and you draw from those in your own life, in your own professional career. There is a real value that you put on telling stories and the necessity to tell stories for doctors. What does it do for doctors to tell stories?
Well, I think it does things for the doctors, and it also does things for medicine and society. So lots of other fields have figured out that the story is the single most effective mode of communication. When people are trying to raise money, if you talk about a plague that's attacking an entire country, you get very little interest. You get it down to one family, you've got more interest. If you even tell the story of two people versus one person, people pay attention for longer and they give more money with that one story. Story is just this sort of fundamental way of communicating, and it's been effective across all cultures and time. And I think too often in medicine, because we're rooted in science, not that science doesn't matter, it's absolutely essential to what we do and the basis of good care, But sometimes we confuse what's the basis of good care with how to communicate about that care. And actually telling a story can win people over much better. I heard, I don't know if it was on this show or another show, someone reporting a new study. I think it had to do with mammography, maybe for women in their 40s. And there was great new data showing that it probably does more harm than good, and so advocating against mammography for women in their 40s. And then someone called in and told the story of her sister, whose breast cancer had been discovered at age 41 or 42 based on a mammogram. And that story of the sister is going to stick with people. It even sticks with me. I can tell you that it was a 41 or 42-year-old sister, and I can't tell you precisely what data point that physician used. So I think we need to get better at using stories to explain things clearly in English as opposed to in medicalese, to capture people's hearts and minds, and to think about using our data and our science sort of more judiciously and clearly, because we tend to undermine the very good work that scientists and physicians do by talking about it in a way that isn't accessible or interesting or entertaining.
Well, you've written some accessible and interesting and entertaining stories here. In fact, most of them I would categorize as realistic tales and tales, as I said, drawn from life. But you you use them in different forms, you know, as well. I mean, you experiment. Numbered lists, diagnostic manual, essentially photographs. Trying essentially to move into different forms, but also not keep yourself shackled, let's say, to just writing about those older people that you deal with in a professional way. You're trying to write about really healthcare.
Right. I wanted it to be a portrait of American healthcare at this moment in time. So the stories are stories of children and adults and older people. I wanted to cover most of the medical specialties, all the different neighborhoods and ethnicities in San Francisco, and use sort of San Francisco as a microcosm of the country.
Yeah, most of them are set here. And in fact, early on, we were talking about working with Cambodians. Early on, we have a Cambodian child who's wetting her bed, you know.
Right.
And that's with all these places familiar to San Franciscans and people in the Bay Area.
Right, yeah. No, there should be – you can map out all the different places, and that was really fun to do. And I used form in a way that is fun for me. I mean, I love people who do interesting things where the form and the content play towards the theme or whatever you're trying to say. But I also wanted to say particular things about medicine. So the photographs we often have long-term relationships with people, and yet what we really see is a series of snapshots. And it's kind of like those books where you flip through the book and you can see all the photographs lined up. And if you flip through it quickly, it looks
like
people are moving. It's like a movie. And so we have that impression, but I wanted to remind us that really all we're seeing is snapshots. And that's not the same as knowing the person's whole life or understanding them completely. You know, and the list form is something doctors make lists all the time. We make lists with little boxes and we like to check off the boxes. And if you're having a really bad day, you'll actually put things on your list that you've already done just to feel like life is under control and you're making progress. So I played with form to sort of play with who we are.
You also play with, fields that are maybe, some might argue, far afield from your own. Mm-hmm. I mean, being a geriatrician and working in geriatrics, a lot about male psychiatrists that appear in your work, for example, one of them doing time in jail, but, you know, another one who kind of gives a diagnosis for just about everything, including members of his own family.
Right.
I mean, these are clearly, I might add, perhaps, or ventured, drawn from colleagues of yours and people you've worked with.
To some degree, the one who's in jail is actually a neurologist and not a psychiatrist. So, but there is a psychiatrist who diagnoses everyone. Yeah, I had a moment in medical school where I thought I might do psychiatry, and it was a little bit, you know, and how you end up in what you end up is partly random because I have all kinds of wonderful friends who are psychiatrists now. But there was a psychiatrist there who just diagnosed everybody and labeled everybody. And so I wanted to call that out because I think we're all so much more than the labels that sometimes are attached to us.
Well, actually, I'm going to open the book here because he has a habit, as I said, of diagnosing or giving diagnostic reasons behind the behavior of his wife and child. There's one point where you write, I was very struck by the language here, about the child. A green-gray blur, a hummingbird hangs above Bougainvillea, a child squeals in the pool. The child is not her child. Her child, and she's sort of relaxing by the pool, being taken care of by a man who's described as an ebony man, waiting on her, bringing her drinks and whatnot. And she's gone through a hell of a lot of stress and burnout and all that. But this is a description of the – so there's a lot of class difference there. But here's a description of the child. Her child is older now and refuses family vacations. Her child cheats on tests he could ace without studying, simultaneously achieving social acceptance and academic mediocrity. Her child wears a ring on the fourth finger of his left hand to honor a vow of celibacy and burns books he considers untruthful or impure, but thinks nothing of piercing his nipples, nose, scrotum, and umbilicus with cheap silver hoops and beaded baubles. That's a pretty graphic picture right there. I mean, and also, you know, the whole generation gap comes into focus, and the whole sense of distance of a mother almost looking at her son with that sense of irony that comes across in that section. So we're well beyond the specter of medicine here and of healthcare. Mm-hmm. We're more into family relationships.
Absolutely. I mean, the book is about people who are doctors and patients, but it's not all about medicine. It's really all about life. But I think medicine is a great way to get at life because it brings us up against who we are as people and as bodies, which is so much of life. So,
do you want to do what Chekhov did? I mean, forgive the towering analogy there. But
yeah, I mean, so lucky.
We should all be so lucky to be a great tale teller, maybe the greatest of one of the greatest, certainly, of all tale tellers, but of at least a short story. He was a playwright, too, but he was also a doctor, and he was able to somehow form very human stories, which I think is what you're trying to do, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think, yeah, he's a master of the craft in so many ways, but one of the things I like best about him, and I think shows the interplay of being a physician and a writer, is the empathy he has for absolutely everyone, and the access and insight he shows to people from all different backgrounds. I do think being a doctor and being a doctor who takes care of people in such a diverse city and also in underserved neighborhoods quite frequently has given me tremendous insight and knowledge as a writer to understand people and their experiences and their backgrounds in a way I might not have otherwise, being just myself.
Make your reader empathize with these characters, too. You also do something called public medical communication and... what is that exactly?
So that's actually a new field in medicine. The term was coined by myself and others at UCSF, and it acknowledges the changed communication world in which we live. So it used to be that if you got information, you read a book or you listened to the radio or maybe you turned on the television, it came at you one way. And now we have social media and even radio and TV are interactive. People are interacting the whole time. And there is this expectation of being more public. So our students and residents are on Facebook constantly and texting and, you know, their lives are right out there and in the open. So that on the one hand. And on the other hand, patients used to only get information from their individual doctor. And now they can go to Dr. Google or to WebMD or any number of other sources, or they can post a question online and get other people's input. And so there's a lot of noise and conversation about medicine. And traditionally, doctors haven't really participated in any of that. And then sometimes they don't participate. And then they're very upset by the results. So the HMO movement in the 90s, for example. So they don't participate because they figure that's not their job. And then conversations happen and they're upset by the policies that result or the funding or what they consider misinformation. So what we're advocating, and this is actually consistent with something called the Physician Charter that came out in 2002 and was adopted by 130 societies across North America and Europe, which said that one of the key responsibilities for physicians was to provide expert advice to society on matters of health. So public medical communication is really training doctors and other healthcare providers to communicate with the public and with each other in effective ways. So it has to do with the where. Right, people are writing lots more op-eds, books, blogs, and even medical journals now. When I get the New England Journal in my inbox, I see essays. I don't see the science. I have to scroll down to get to the science because we're human too, and we really like to read the stories and the essays. So it has to do with the where and also the how. It's what I was talking about earlier, that people enjoy more reading things that draw them in some way, whether that's story or something you didn't expect. So the where and the how, and training physicians to communicate effectively with each other and others is what public medical communication is.
Dr. Louise Aronson, author of A History of the Present Illness, is our guest. And that communication also includes, or ought to include, the ability to admit to mistakes. I want to talk about this with you for a moment. I'm sure we'll probably hear from listeners on this. It seems to me that some doctors are about as incapable of saying that they've made a mistake as, let's say, the President of the United States or Presidents of the United States seem to be incapable of that. And a lot of that's fear of malpractice, but also the idea of, and a lot of medicos are fairly certain of their deities, in many instances, and they're treated like that. They're given a kind of deference or veneration that seems to go with the territory, and as a result, arrogance is often bred, and certainty that brooks no quarter and is just not even flexible. So what I'm getting at here, and I guess you probably know this, Dr. Brian Goldman, the importance of physicians being able to make mistakes and say that they've made mistakes.
Absolutely. I think there's huge variability both generationally and among different specialties in how much that's part of who you are. Are you really a deity? Do you have that much power? And can you admit mistakes? There's also really good data going back at least 15 years now that physicians who admit to errors and talk about errors are A, less likely to be sued, and B, more likely to learn from their mistakes and not commit further errors. So the malpractice excuse, I would say, isn't much of an excuse. And I guess my own personal bias would be that there's rarely ever an occasion for arrogance. But you're right. We do see this, as we like to say in medicine. And people are treated deferentially. One of the other things I do is something called reflective writing or reflective learning. And this dates back to John Dewey in the 30s, but it's just entered medicine in the last 10 years. And UCSF is one of the centers that's really working hard on this. And that has to do with thinking about when an experience happens, usually one that doesn't go quite as you expected, to think about it in a way that allows you to learn from it, reframe it, and consequently be a better professional as a result of it.
Our guest again is Louise Aronson, and I want to take this opportunity to invite listeners to join us. We're talking about a whole range of things having to do with medicine and certainly with healthcare, with geriatrics, with storytelling and fiction writing, because she wears both hats and has published a book called A History of the Present Illness and is an award-winning storyteller as well as a physician who wears many hats even in that role. If you'd like to join us, we certainly welcome your participation. If you have questions or comments or simply want to join the conversation, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786. And again, we welcome your questions or comments. The toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also join us on our website and our Facebook page or email us, forum@kqed.org. But do feel free to be a part of this conversation. We'd like to hear from you. Again, Louise Aronson, UCSF physician and author, talking about her new story collection, A History of the Present Illness, which is set in San Francisco, and the stories draw on her experiences working with the sick and elderly in the city's hospitals and nursing homes, but certainly have a lot more to do with just a range of humanity and storytelling. When we return, we'll hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Louise Aronson, and Dr. Louise Aronson is an associate professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and directs the Northern California Geriatrics Education Center at UCSF and the UCSF Pathways to Discovery Program. She's also the author of a collection of 16 stories called A History of the Present Illness. And we certainly welcome your involvement in this conversation. I want to mention again that you can join the discussion by giving us a call at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email any questions or comments you have to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and you can also, of course, go to our Facebook page at KQED Forum. I'm going to go to callers and emailers here in just a moment. What I want to go to next, though, is just a subject that I'd like to find out what Dr. Aronson has to say, because she deals so much with end of life and with aging and with illnesses, particularly that afflict those, the end of life. We've done a lot of programs on that subject, and I know it's something that concerns listeners, long-term care and all of the emotional dimensions of taking care of older people, not only from the healthcare standpoint, but also from caretakers and so forth. But you did you published an article in the New York Times about your experience with your dog named Byron. And the veterinarian said something which I not only grabbed a hold of you, but me as well, because I've had to put dogs down, and, you know, horrible to go through for any dog lover, anybody who loves their dog. But sometimes you feel you want to do it to a loved one. You want to have them escape that pain, or at least euthanate, or take the opportunity to do that. And we can't. It's that simple.
Right.
So the ruling, or the operative rule from the veterinarian was 50-50, he called it, right?
Right.
He said, if the dog has one good day and one bad day, let the dog live. If there's two bad days to every good day, then quality of life has gotten to a point where it's maybe time to put the dog under. Same thing would easily be said about human beings, couldn't it?
I think it's interesting to think about. One of the things, it brings up such an important topic, but I think the reason I liked it was it's a conversation starter, but it also misses the key point, which is that we will all make different decisions. And the single most important thing I think we can do as we get older and towards the end of life is to figure out what we want or what the people we love who are in that position want. So really, if you think about how we provide medical care or how we deal with our loved ones, we rarely have those conversations. And those conversations about what matters most to you and what scares you most and how do you want to be living the rest of your life and what sorts of things would make your life not worthwhile are the single most important discussions.
It's too verboten a topic for most people. But if you come right down to it, you might want to say, look, if the quality of life has gotten so bad that every couple days is more terrible than one day, give me the hemlock. But you don't have that option.
Well, we definitely don't have that option, but I also have...
Or have the doctor give me the hemlock.
Right, exactly. Well, some states have more of that option than others. But the other thing that I've learned as a geriatrician now for almost 20 years is that in the exact same condition, some people will say to me and have said to me, my life is not worth living. Can't you do something? And others will say, I don't care what it takes. I want to stay alive. And that's why we just can't have a 50-50 rule. What we need and what we should do in every single electronic medical record is have an area for goals of care or for naming a proxy and talking about what you value most with that person. It's really interesting when we speak to other sorts of physicians about their care of older people, and they say, I don't have time to deal with, you know, how they want to live or how they want to die or how they want to function or, you know, I need to control their diabetes and their hypertension and deal with this possible cancer. And my answer to that is, if you don't know how a person wants to live and what they value most, you can't make decisions about their hypertension or their diabetes or their potential cancer. That these are actually the single most important bits of information we need to get from people. And it is in keeping with our society's culture to let everybody make their decisions, but also for us as professionals to inform those decisions.
Well, so I'm with you completely here, and I know a lot of the listeners are, and it gets back to what I was talking about with touching patients. And I mean, this is not literally touching, but it's touching their lives and being able to converse with them about the things that really matter to them, and maybe even establishing something that borders on intimacy or closeness with patients where they become important to you in that vital way. And it's difficult. I mean, there's so many barriers, not least of all the paperwork and the kind of demands and exigencies of what are on physicians' shoulders.
Right. Well, the paperwork, and also we have a system that rewards sort of technology and procedures and not relationships and conversations. And by reward, I mean financial rewards. You know, people who do the same procedure over and over, change the lens in your eye, get paid double what the people do who might spend an hour or an hour and a half for which they will not be paid. Figuring out what you want most and how best to deal with this new lump you've found. There are some incredible people in my division of geriatrics at UCSF that have done amazing work in this area. So Rebecca Sidori has a prepare website that you can go to think about what you want or what your loved one wants. There's something called e-prognosis, thinking about how much longer do I have? Because I know for me, what I would decide to do in the next 5 years would matter a lot if I'm going to die in 5 years or I'm going to die in 20 years. And then several people, Louise Walter and Say Lee and Ken Kavinsky, have done work thinking about how do you decide when a test is appropriate? You know, we often treat people based on the disease, not on who they are. So the NIH, for example, is organized around diseases. And if you're 90 and you're in a wheelchair and require oxygen, you're not going to live 10 years to benefit from that colonoscopy. But if you're 90, a friend of mine has a patient like this, and the patient walks across the Golden Gate Bridge to see my colleague, well, then that man should probably have a colonoscopy because he's in great shape. But to treat them as if those are the exact same person and to not ask them what they value most and to not inform them about what the likelihood of the rest of their life.
Can you give me that man's telephone number?
Yes, isn't that impressive?
I want to talk to him.
Genes are important also.
Let me go to our callers. And we begin, John, with you. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to know the difference between a geriatric doctor and a gerontologist, and whether or not the doctor believes that a older person, particularly one who has medical issues, should have one or the other of those doctors as a primary care physician.
Geriatric doctor or a gerontologist?
Gerontologist. Yeah, so that's actually a great question. Comes up all the time. So a geriatrician is a physician, so somebody with an MD or a DO that has specialized first in internal medicine or family medicine. Doctor of osteopathy, sorry. Bad at using acronyms. That has specialized first in internal medicine or family medicine and then done special training, additional training, to gain expertise in the care of older adults and their conditions. A gerontologist, by contrast, is someone who has either a master's degree or a PhD in the study of aging. And they're more often involved in policy, administration, research in non-medical areas of aging. So if you needed a physician or a primary care person, you would want a geriatrician for your older person. And, you know, we often define old age as 65, which is antiquated. That designation was made when most of us were dead around 65 or 70.
It used to be a de rigueur to retire at age 65. That's why it
exactly. Think, well, and we died at a much younger age back when that was made the case. So what counts as old? I mean, again, this brings up my recurring theme of that old is individual. So some people would need a geriatrician, someone who thinks more holistically about you and your function and your quality of life and uses their special expertise to manage those problems at 70. And others might not need it until they're 85. So it's a combination of age plus illness burden plus ability to function that really determines whether or not a geriatrician would be helpful. But as people get very old into their 80s, 90s, and 100s, and certainly as they have greater amounts of disability or burden of disease, then a geriatrician is absolutely the best physician for that person.
And John, we thank you for the call and the question, and we go right to another caller. Ken, you're on. Hi.
Hi, Michael. I've enjoyed the conversation, but I think to some extent, in the interest of telling good stories, you're getting away from one of the main precepts of modern science, which is avoiding the use of anecdotal evidence and using large amounts of data and statistics and all those other important scientific principles to make sure that what you're actually dealing with is real and not just, you know, the unusual occurrence among the real observation.
Boy, that's a really interesting observation Ken's making here. I mean, storytelling can be anecdotal, and it can take you perhaps away from, I mean, you're talking about all these medical journals, even JAMA beginning with stories now, take you away from the methodical, habitual, over and over again kind of empiricism.
Right. Well, I think that's confusing a little bit the how with the what. So the what, the content, absolutely must be based on science, large numbers, et cetera. We often say in medicine that anecdotal evidence is not helpful and that people can have one experience and then do the wrong thing when the data shows something counter to that experience. So, yes, what we do and what we advocate for must be based on the science and the data. But how you – what I'm talking about is not getting away from that by any means. It's to use a story to get people to understand the data better and to be interested in it. Because often if you lead with the statistics, people are bored or they're confused. If you pick the right story that exemplifies what the data shows, you then get their attention and you help them understand the data in a way they might not have been able to otherwise.
Which of your stories do you think particularly would epitomize what you just stated? That is, shows the data in a way through the narrative that you particularly want people to learn about through the story, so as opposed to just telling a story, which sometimes has no didactic purpose other than giving you this sense, this tranche de vie, slice of life, whatever.
Right. It's funny. In the book, I think less of that I was trying to show. When I was answering that question, I was thinking more of if you had the results of a research trial, how would you do that?
I understand, but I just wondered if it applied to your own work or if you think it applies to – because you're really just telling stories here.
Yeah. No, I think many of them do. Blurred boundary disorder gets at what are we doing with the DSM and what data do we actually have on how we make diagnoses of psychiatric disorders. Several of the stories about older adults also get at the data that we know increasingly that we have traditionally only counted quantity of life, not quality. And there have been several studies, maybe more than several at this point in the last couple of years, showing that if you add in palliative care and think about symptoms and comfort and quality of life, even in people who have terminal diagnoses like cancer or end-stage kidney disease, you improve both the length of life and the quality of life.
Well, we've got a story about a character named Maurice who's mm-hmm. dying of cancer, and it's an old joke story too, super sex. I'll take the soup.
Right.
I'm not giving away anything with the plot here, but it really does distinguish that line between palliative care as opposed to when you know it's time to pull the shutters.
Exactly. So I have tried to illustrate that in several of the stories.
Let me bring another caller in here, and that's Randy. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to go back to something the doctor was talking about earlier in regard to doctors having a conversation with patients about when errors happen or when something doesn't go right. My previous job and my old employer, I was what's called the ombudsman mediator for several years, and it was a great job because it was an opportunity to bring doctors and patients' families together when there was what they call an unforeseen adverse outcome. And it was a great opportunity to have that confidential, private discussion between clinicians and the patients and their families when something didn't go the way it was expected. And being able to talk about it in an open and safe environment, it's really important. It really does, in most cases, it doesn't work perfectly, but it does, in most cases, allow patients and families to come to understanding, one, that medicine's not an exact science, and two, it's important to understand that things don't go the way they expect. And unfortunately, that's the way it is. And it's also an opportunity for doctors in this manner to be able to talk about the event and not feel like they have lawyers standing over them concerning of what they're going to say. I've had doctors and patients both cry and hug each other during that process because they really do come to a clear understanding of each other. And I think it's important that we need to do more of that in medicine. That's all I wanted to say.
Well, thank you for saying it, Randy. Appreciate Louise Aronson.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And I think we're beginning in the last 10 years to start training physicians as they're in medical school and in residency to have more of those conversations. And those are conversations where you admit and discuss error. There are conversations where you discuss patients' treatment or hard diagnoses. And we used to not train people to do that. And I think one of the things that forgets is that we're all human. So number one, we will sometimes make mistakes. And number two, we as human beings are also uncomfortable. And the more experience and practice you can get, and the more training you can get from people who are truly expert at having these conversations, the better you can do it. That said, I should acknowledge that when a mistake happens, there are a few things that need to happen. You need to discuss it with the patient and family so everybody understands. And you also need to look at your own actions, the actions of your team, the way the system is set up, to see if there are things we could do to lessen the errors, because there are a lot more errors than we need now, as some of this checklist work by Peter Provenost and others has shown.
A couple of listener comments from our website. One listener writes, I'm happy that Dr. Aronson is writing about healthcare and medicine. While Dr. Aronson asserted that doctors have empathy for their patients, I must take exception with that assertion. I worked in healthcare for over 30 years, not as either a doctor or a nurse, and I found that doctors are like everyone else. Some have empathy, compassion, and are selfless, while others are not caring. You would agree?
I would agree.
Then a listener writes on the website, having to do with fiction, you know how Tom Wolfe had that whole bitter criticism of Roth et al. For not writing about the larger world a la Balzac, Zola, Hugo. This woman is doing it. Looking forward to reading her book. Actually, I don't know if Roth came under that Tom Wolfe argument, but it's, as I remember the argument, it was a fascinating one. It was more the kind of experimental writers who were fabulists, who were moving away from realism and or realism and naturalism, not using those kind of storytelling techniques and doing things that were much more collage-like or experimental, involve more reader collaboration, were innovative, really, and exciting for in some areas of fiction. But Tom Wolfe said, let's get back to, you know, basic Balzac type of storytelling. He did believe in that. And I think despite your experiments with form, you do too.
I think so. I mean, I like both types of reading, but I felt I could capture more both the individual experiences and the larger experience by sticking with the realist form.
You'd be more comfortable, let me put it this way, you'd be more comfortable with, say, the world of Cheever and Jhumpa Lahiri, perhaps, than you would of Donald Barthelme, let's say, or
I've read
Robert
both,
Coover.
But it's true. I get up more often when reading Coover and Barthelme and find, you know, that I need a drink of water or something.
We'll have another caller join us. Toby, hi.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having Dr. Aronson on. Great show. I just want to make a plug-in for the Geriatric Education Center, both Northern at UCSF, of which I was a part of as a student and a nurse at UCSF for years, but also Stanford's Geriatric Education Center. They have a number of modules on ethnogeriatrics that I utilize teaching my nursing students, and it's just wonderful that the federal, you know, like a HRSA grant requires that they not only do the research but translate it. And so we're in partnership with them getting the information out. But my students at San Jose State, who are like amazingly diverse population that will be serving an amazingly diverse population, really get on. The ones that are of the same ethnic culture get on and learn things about their culture they didn't even know because they're American-born and not coming from where their grandparents came from. But in caring for them in our nurse-managed centers and in their future work out in the field, it's just been amazingly helpful. And anybody can get on and look at them and see them, but it's, as part of our studies, we include them. So I wanted to say that. And the last I wanted to say is I took my 17-year-old daughter to see the Rolling Stones the other night in San Jose just to show my daughter what geriatrics can look like.
Thank you for that call.
I didn't know where that was going.
Yeah,
that
neither did I. are you familiar with the work being done at the Buck Institute?
Some of it, yes.
Yeah. I mean, some of it's pretty impressive. We've done programs with some of the professionals there, and it's kind of a little bit of a hidden gem, you know, in terms of the Bay Area, not really knowing it's up there.
Without
in Nevada,
question, yeah. So it's got a lovely campus up in Marin, and they do some really cutting-edge basic science about aging. We tend to hear more of what goes on here in San Francisco or at Stanford, which is more translating that to patients.
Well, you don't have that many institutes of aging. In fact, it may be one of the only ones in the country of its kind.
That do basic science. Yeah. There are a lot of labs that are funded by the National Institutes on Aging, but it's true you hear more about what the last caller mentioned, which is like our Northern California Geriatric Education Center, which is funded through the Health Resources and Services Agency.
Constance, you're our next caller. Welcome.
Thank you. Dr. Aronson, I'm a pediatrician in Washington, D.C., and I wonder how you structure your day, your week, your weekends to combine your patient care, your teaching, and your reflective time.
With difficulty, and it's constantly in flux, but that is a great question. I think I have different balances in different weeks. The reflective time I find works best for me early while exercising and on weekends. And then, of course, if something happens, I do that. And much of the rest of the day is structured through my UCSF activities. I think part of it for me in getting this book written was, number one, not to really have a timeline because I already had a great and satisfying profession. And the other, to realize that sometimes I was going to do a lot of work and sometimes I was going to do less work. And I think being forgiving and seeing the long haul helps, but it's an ongoing challenge. I don't have a good answer for that one. I'm sorry.
Well, good luck to you, Constance, and thank you for the call. And you're listening to Forum. We're talking with Dr. Louise Aronson. Her book is out and available. It's called A History of the Present Illness, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And our next caller from Oakland is Tom. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Your discussion about geriatric care and touching patients kind of triggered in my mind, which I want to add a little element of skepticism, because I work at a major HMO in the Bay Area. And no doubt, I feel that 99% of our healthcare providers and healthcare frontline staff are dedicated professionals. But over the years, I've kind of felt a certain sense of dejectedness and burnout and losing hope. And I can see it in the expressions of our MDs and nurses and other allied professionals, in the sense that they want to do the right thing, but the system is not allowing it to. And I fear with the oncoming launch date of healthcare reform, most of which is cost-cutting, there's going to be more of the sort of things being implemented that makes healthcare professionals kind of long for the old days. And I'm reminded of the movie regarding geriatric care, the movie Soylent Green, if you remember, with Edward G. Robinson, where he was in a room at kind of like a modernized hospice program, and things were turning into green stuff, you know, after your loved ones have passed away, and to make your passing way as comfortable as possible and inconsequential. So, but the green stuff that's being chased around in our modern-day healthcare is the dollar sign, and a lot of it is being implemented. For one thing, I have an uncle who has colon cancer, and the degree to which the healthcare system pushes DNRs and palliative care, hospice care, non-intervention, no extraordinary admission, some of it is very unseemly. It reminds me of the time when my dog was dying. The veterinarian came up to the family and, well, you know, he's going to have some good days and bad days. There's no up from here with the quality of life. So let's just put him down now. So I kind of feel that's sort of a metaphor we're going towards with human health care. Who's to make that determination?
Well, Tom, let me cut to the chase here. I think Tom's talking about just the increased nature of, well, procedures that don't have to be done and doctoring that doesn't have to be done. It's really about money making. I mean, you're an academic world of medicine, and that's a very different world, but it's a world we live in, certainly.
It's definitely a world we live in. And I think it's an issue we absolutely need to address with the amount of our budgets nationally, locally, and at the state level going towards healthcare. We turn out to be one of the countries that spends the most money on procedures and technology and the least money on the social aspects of medical care that really make people's lives possible and allow them to function well. So I think one of the opportunities of the coming healthcare reform will be to think about ways in which we can provide better care at less cost. And there are lots of great models for that are already out there, but we're not adopting them as effectively as we might.
I'm going to read an email from a listener named Gail who writes, My experience at UCSF in particular was far from satisfactory when my mother, who had been a patient at UC for 40 years, was treated with indifference, left to die unattended for hours in their emergency room. She was over 90 years old, scared, very, very ill, and finally, once a physician saw her, he said to her and her husband to go home to die. I was there, so this is not hearsay. That is my story, and my feeling is that there is a vastly overrated idea of what sensitive medical treatment can be at UCSF. I don't know what you say to that, but
I say to that, I'm incredibly sorry that happened, and that, you know, my family and I also are patients at UCSF, and I think like any big institution, there's a huge variety there's lots of variety in the sort of care you get.
Haven't we said it before? There are caring doctors and non-caring doctors.
There are.
At UCSF, like everywhere else.
But clearly that experience was terrible, and I'm very, very sorry about it.
Sounds pretty terrible. Here's Hank, who writes, Mr. Krasny just asked about the veterinarian's advice, which I agree with. So I'm an organ donor, but I don't want to die at great prolonged expense in a hospital. Can I park a camper van in a nearby lot in my last days to have a quiet end and still be of some use after I die so material can be quickly harvested? If I weren't an organ donor, I'd go to the wilderness and let the vultures take care of the remains. Well, okay, we'll let that stand. And one more email I want to get in here. Eric writes, you asked Dr. Aronson about many doctors' hesitation, refusal to admit they were wrong on specific diagnosis or point of care. Can Dr. Aronson comment on a physician's responsibility to tell a patient that they don't have to continue treatments or pursue a cure? Very quickly, if we could.
That's a great question. I think too many doctors still think that pursuing a cure equals care, whereas care is actually presenting all the options. And just because you're not going to treat something in the traditional way doesn't mean you're not providing care. If someone has a very bad cancer and they're very old and treatment won't help them anyway and they don't want to be treated, making them comfortable and making the last days of their lives as meaningful as possible, that's care. That's good medical care, and that's where we need to move.
And we'll let it stand there. Louise Aronson's book, again, is A History of the Present Illness. Thank you so much for joining us on Forum.
Thank you very much for having me.
Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Senior editor Dan Zoll. Executive producer Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.